you get something from nothing? Not easily, it would seem. From empty chaos, somehow sea and earth and air appeared. They drifted around, pieces of each getting lost in the other. No water was swimmable. No land was walkable. No gas was breathable. Anything hot could quickly turn cold. Anything cold could burst into flames. Shapes shifted. Textures shifted. Objects merged one into the other effortlessly. Then suddenly, slam, one or both turned inexplicably hard. What was heavy became weightless. What was weightless crashed through earth and sea and air, shattering and splattering and scattering bits of everything and nothing. Rules of nature? They didn't operate. Indeed, there was no nature. There was nothing reliable in this turmoil except lack of order. And lack is the essence of need. Out of that original need came the mother force, Gaia, all on her own. Need can do that. Gaia sucked up heat and stored it in her heart. She wrapped herself round and round with anything solid she could reach, growing firmer with each layering. She pulled together her glassy sands, lifting them grain by grain, free of air to form deserts, free of water to form beaches. She pushed together gigantic plates of rock until her mountains rose high, so far from her scalding heart that snow could settle on their peaks. As Gaia disentangled herself from the waters and the gases, the seas fell together in giant puddles. The heavens arched over it, and in this way the emergence of Gaia led to both the wholeness of the seas and the wholeness of the heavens. And Gaia was generous. Gaia was generous, as a mother should be. She opened her veins so water could rush through rivers and creeks and pool together in large low lakes and small hidden ponds. She yielded here and there to the gases, allowing crevices to cradle them. One crevice in particular was huge and gaping, the waiting hole for the dead. But at this point, she didn't know that. She knew things only as they happened. Like a child encountering everything for the first time, she created the whole almost as though she understood instinctively all the gain and all the loss that would follow from her generosity. The seas learned from Gaia and welcomed islands. The skies learned from Gaia and welcomed stars. And then the seas and skies went further and worked together to cycle water from the salty seas to the skies, then fresh and sweet to the lands, who returned it once more to the seas. And Gaia was not the only child of that enormous original need that came from chaos. There were others: Tartarus, the underworld; Eros, love. And then chaos gave a huge yawn, and outflowed the total darkness of night, as well as Erebus. Erebus, like Gaia, was a place as well as a force, seeking to fill crannies. And so Erebus settled into the hole for the dead and became part of the underworld. And Eros was beautiful, not ordinary beautiful. Eros's beauty made the others quiver. It made them dream. Made them dream of being enveloped in warm caresses, of getting drunk on the thick, creamy honey, of swooning from ambrosia, of whirling to tinkling music, of being dazzled by the sparkles in this lightless world, for it was still so dark. And so night and Erebus fell in love, and night gave birth to day. And with light, in the lushness of fresh and salty water, and in that expansiveness of air, life on earth began. Grasses and vines wound their way around the globe. Bushes gently bloomed. The earth had become, and everything to come, good and bad, was to follow. So you probably figured out that's not traditional Buddhist material. So this is a retelling of the Greek myth, ancient Greek myth of creation. Beautifully retold by a children's author named Donna Jo Napoli. I found it in a book of my son's the other day. I was casting around the house for something to read to him to help him to wake up. He's always been so focused on stories and narrative that the only reliable way to get him to wake up for school is to read him a story, because he's motivated, he wants to wake up so he can hear the story. So I read him that the other day at 7 in the morning. And so it's a story of awakening in more than one way. But it's also just another tale, another perspective, another attitude about how we all create the world, isn't it? We all have our own mythology of who we are and how we came into being. We all have our own idea of what's solid, what's light, and what's heavy. And it might be a little more turbulent than we think, or maybe less turbulent than we think. This world that we perceive appears in some ways to be orderly, but maybe that's the work of the mind, trying to make sense of the jumble of perception and thought that emerges on every moment. Each of us in our own way, like Gaia, wrapping our arms around the drifting forms, opening our heart to the heat of life. Each of us creating our world moment after moment. Each of our worlds unique, no two quite the same. Each of us the center of the world we've created, believing it to be the real world. And like Guy, each of us leaving holes into the underworld with our dark thoughts and our pain, and also our love and our poetry and our joy and our amazement. And so I was thinking Sesshin is such a great opportunity to watch all of this in action. It's happening all the time, of course, but maybe we don't notice so much. To be able to sit on our little cushions and doing our many jobs, to watch the arising of our own mythology, to watch the world being created. I mean, Norman used to say, everyone's a philosopher. We could also say, everyone has our own mythology. Everyone has our own creation myth. And it's really a myth of the self, isn't it? A myth of me. A myth of me. And we're carrying our myth forward all the time, editing, improving, embellishing, being annoyed by, being proud of. At times feeling really stuck with our myth. At times feeling, what a relief, I don't have to do that anymore. And so we can slow down a little bit. These couple of days. And be curious about this myth-making. Not to try to stop it or repress it in some way. We couldn't do that even if we wanted to. Maybe you've noticed that. But maybe to understand it in a little different way than usual. Maybe to sort of touch that process in a certain way, with some love, with some caring. Because, you know, sometimes we misunderstand Sesshin, this activity we're doing, Sesshin. Sometimes we misunderstand this as a way to improve, a way to get better. As a time that we can, like, get something, get some understanding, get some peace, or whatever it is you're trying to get. And that's a natural aspect of the mind that creates this world. Naturally, we would want that. But as we practice, it becomes so clear to us, doesn't it? Doesn't it that it doesn't really seem to work that way? There doesn't seem to be a process of manipulation and control that works and makes us feel better. I was thinking this is a little bit reflected in our American Zen understanding of that word itself, this word sesshin. At first I remember being told by our Dharma leaders, none of whom were Japanese speakers, I don't think, and even maybe a Japanese speaker might not know this word, because the Japanese words that are used in Zen are not like regular Japanese words. Everything in our tradition is deeply coded, you know, many layers of translation and meaning. Simple in a way, but in a way very deep and hard to know. And so anyway, I remember being told at the beginning that sesshin means to gather the mind, to gather in the mind, and that makes sense. Sit still, kind of gather things together, just like Gaia's arms again, right? Gather the mind so you can do something with the mind, improve the mind maybe. Take all this chaos and gather it up into our arms and form it, shape it. Shape it into a new world according to the teachings of Buddha. That sounds really good. Have a Buddha life. It would be better probably to have a Buddha life than an ordinary life. So we were told it means to gather the mind. And then someone looked it up, looked up the actual word in the character dictionary. I think it actually might have been Kate McCandless, so this might be like a Northwest teaching. And maybe it'll turn out to be wrong anyway, but that's okay. It's helpful. And that's the other great thing about all these layers of meaning is even if you're wrong, it's still helpful. Somehow the tradition works that way. So anyway, Kate McCandless looked up the word, this word, sesshin, and she found it doesn't actually mean to gather the mind. It means to touch the mind. And actually this word that we say, mind, sheen, has an aspect of heart too. That the Asian languages have one character for heart and mind together, not separated. You know, we have this sort of fundamental separation between the head and the body, right? So not so much. Not so much that. And to touch the heart mind has a really different feeling than gathering something, doesn't it? Because we, you know, we gather things with a closed hand to hold on to them. When you pull the hand back, you expect there to be something there. Something at last to slow down the chaos, to hold on to something true, something real, something beyond. But we touch things with an open hand, right? So we touch things with an open hand. So just to touch the mind, just to touch the heart, gently, with a lot of care, with kindness, with patience, to feel the warmth of our life through the palm of the hand. And this retreat is the closing of our winter practice period. Many of you were involved in that, but not everybody, which is fine. And we've been exploring what we've been calling the heart of the matter, the heart of the matter in our practice period. And we've been using the short Buddhist text, the Heart Sutra, which we chanted this morning, as the center of that inquiry. And the Heart Sutra has been teaching us something about emptiness. But this really just as a jumping off point to jump right back into our life. And the Heart Sutra is really kind of an odd little text, isn't it? If you've studied the Heart Sutra, or even maybe just chanting it this morning if you'd never seen it before. Do you notice all those negations and lists of things, and then there's this mantra at the end, and it's kind of a strange little text. So it's interesting that it's so central to our tradition. When we study it, we usually say it's some kind of a summary text of a bigger literature about wisdom, the Prajnaparamita literature. But if any of us was setting out to write a summary of that literature, we would not come up with anything remotely like the Heart Sutra, I don't think. So maybe it's not quite right to say it's a summary of anything. And it's also oddly different in style from the longer sutras that it's supposedly summarizing, which has led some scholars to think it might have actually been composed later in China, not sourced back to India, which is the source culture and place for our tradition. which was shocking apparently to some other scholars, and there was a scholarly flame war about this. But that aside, maybe the Heart Sutra is more like a blast of enthusiasm, an expression of wonder emerging from practice, from the practice of this wisdom, this prajna paramita, this touching the heart with open hand, feeling our life in a certain way. And as we've been studying the text, we've been realizing that actually it might not be that the words of the text themselves are so important as much as the way those words are transmitted to us and the way those words are practiced with as we recite and study and chant this little sutra. And one of the things that's come up in our conversations about the Heart Sutra are people's memories of where they first encountered the Heart Sutra and the different pivotal times in their life it's popped up. It's really quite uncanny. And if for you it's not the Heart Sutra, maybe it's some other little text or teaching or event or something you heard one time, it just pops up at the right time somehow. Do you know what I mean? Just think for a moment what that is for you. Maybe the Heart Sutra, maybe something else. What comes to mind? And so I was remembering, for me, I just thought about this the other day when I was writing this talk, that I first encountered the Heart Sutra at Santa Cruz Zen Center in about 1985. And I was going to the Zen Center there, I didn't know at the time, but it turned out later it was kind of a transitional period, a sort of a time when the center kind of almost collapsed on itself. The previous founding teacher was long gone with most of his students, and the teachers later to come had not thought of going there yet, I guess. And so there was just this one couple really taking care of the Zendo, and I would go early in the morning on my way to university on my bike and sit with this one couple. Sometimes this one other guy would be there, also kind of young guy, not as young as me. I was maybe about 20. Or 19 even. And I don't remember the name of the couple. I remember the guy was an Aikido teacher. And we just had a very simple practice. We would just sit and then chant the Heart Sutra. That was the whole practice there in those at that time, as far as I knew. I was kind of shy. There might have been more going on that I didn't know about. And I remember at one point the couple were out of town or something like that, and so they left the other young man in charge of, you know, opening the Zendo and doing the schedule, because that's really the core practice of Zen. All this other stuff is just sort of entertainment to keep us going, actually. It's the main purpose of the talk here. It's just entertainment. So I hope it's entertaining. The main practice is just doing the schedule, you know, just sitting down. And so naturally, if you leave your Zendo unattended, you ask somebody to please open the door at 6 o'clock and ring the bell and so on. And so I asked the other young man to do that. And he didn't want to chant the Heart Sutra afterwards, after they left, you know. And I remember how upset I was. It was really uncanny. Like, why would I care, you know? The other thing I remember is that particular translation of the Heart Sutra had many more words in Sanskrit. It was one of the earlier translations in English. I remember in particular it had left in Sanskrit, or maybe back translated to Sanskrit, since all this stuff came through China and Japan for us. It had the term for the enlightenment that's described in the Heart Sutra is Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. So I always think of Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, having chanted it as a young man in this little converted garage in Santa Cruz with just a couple of other people. And so I've been trying to say a few words about the Heart Sutra, and it seems to connect to so many other things that we had 5 or 6 lectures on it, and we only got a couple of sentences into the text, I'm sorry to say. It's a little embarrassing. I feel like I didn't do what I was supposed to do or something like that, but we're having a good time with it. And maybe understanding every word is not so important. Maybe there's something here about receiving this text and inquiring into this text and seeing how it reflects our life. That's the important part. There's a Zen poem we chant sometimes that says something like, the meaning is not in the words, the meaning is not in the words, but it responds to the inquiring impulse. So maybe that's the way it is for us. That from warm hands in the past, we've been handed forward some feeling, some inquiring impulse, some way to be together. And we chant the Heart Sutra not as like lecture notes to remind us of important things that we're supposed to remember, but as celebration, as recognition, as gratitude. And another way to look at the Heart Sutra is that not like it's a short explanatory text, but more like it's actually a mantra. The whole thing is a mantra, maybe. A mantra about the wisdom of compassion, about the wisdom of connection, about the wisdom of feeling this myth we've wrapped ourselves in, seeing it for what it is. And so it's really wonderful and strange to be sitting here, don't you think? I often think that when I come in the door here. How could all this be here? How could you be here? How could I be here? How could I be here sitting here in my 46th year? I think it's 28 years after I first set foot in a zendo, wearing a version of a Tang Dynasty Chinese robe with color coding, the color coding of a lineage holder, sitting across this sort of carefully constructed little altar, everything in a particular place, from my own teacher, who's more or less in the same position, oddly sitting there. Each of us sitting here, through the courtesy of all kinds of odd karmic twists and turns, different for each one of us. How strange that could all have happened. And I really don't take it for granted. I don't think there's anything extra special about me or about us. We're not better or luckier than other people that we ended up here now. But we did end up here now. So we are lucky. We have an opportunity. We have an invitation from beyond in some way. Each of us a jewel. Every one of us a jewel, reflecting the other jewels in this room, reflecting all the jewels in our life, reflecting all the jewels in the universe. Each jewel having its place to take. And so we just honor that as best we can. We notice our crazy thoughts and the swirling chaos. Maybe we think our place to take is not the right one, not what we wanted. Maybe it might be the right one, but we're not worthy, we're not good enough. Or maybe the others are not good enough. Or maybe they're better than us. And on and on it goes, doesn't it? Just like in the Greek myth there. So I thought we might enjoy another myth together. A few lines from the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines Sutra, which is a part of the literature that the Heart Sutra supposedly is a summary of. I read a bit of this the other night in the seminar, but we didn't spend any time on it, so I thought we might hear it again, maybe a little slower, and just enjoy another little myth. To support us, in enjoying this inquiry into our own myth. Thus have I heard at one time, the Buddha dwelt at Rajagriha on the Vulture Peak. together with a great gathering of monks and nuns, with 1,250 monks and nuns. So he thought Oryoki with 40 was complicated, so they had 1,250. All of them advanced practitioners, all of them arhats, with their outflows dried up, undefiled, fully controlled, freed in their hearts, well freed and very wise, thoroughbreds, great serpents, their work done, their task accomplished, their burdens laid down, their work accomplished, with the fetters that bind them extinguished, their hearts well freed by right understanding, in perfect control of their whole minds, with the exception of one single person, the Venerable Ananda. I really relate to Ananda, you know, it's like he's my favorite character in all these stories. So let me do a little, excuse me, I have a bad habit of digressing, but that's my thing, so too bad for you. So what's great about Ananda, do you know a little bit the story of Ananda? What's great about Ananda is he was the Buddha's cousin, his right-hand man for 20 or 30 years, heard all the teachings, memorized almost all the teachings, you know, really smart guy, you know, and very devoted. You know, you could not fault his practice or his understanding or his passion for Dharma, and yet he didn't quite get it, you know. Can you relate to that? I don't quite get it. So everyone but Ananda got it. And then Ananda drops out of the story, but we just had to mention that he was sitting there, you know. Maybe, I don't know if he knows he doesn't get it. Do you know that you don't get it? Maybe you do. And then the Lord said to another disciple, the Venerable Subhuti, the elder, "Make it clear now, Subhuti, to all the bodhisattvas, the great beings, starting from perfect wisdom, tell them all how the bodhisattvas go forth into perfect wisdom. Tell them how to practice." So the Buddha empowers one disciple, Subhuti, to teach. And thereupon, another disciple, the Venerable Sariputra, thought to himself, "Oh, will that Venerable Subhuti the Elder expound perfect wisdom of himself through the operation and force of his own power of revealing wisdom? Will he do it through his own understanding, or will he do it through the Buddha's might?" So we wonder that, don't they? You know, how do they know that? You know, where is this coming from? So the Buddha empowers someone to teach, and the other students are wondering, like, huh, where is this coming from? And thereupon, the Venerable Subhuti, by the Buddha's might, said to the Buddha, "The Buddha has said, 'Make it clear now, Subhuti, to the bodhisattvas, the great beings, starting from perfect wisdom, how the bodhisattvas, the great beings, should go forth into perfect wisdom and how they should practice.'" So the Buddha asked Subhuti to speak. Subhuti then said, "I've been empowered to speak." And then he says, "Well, when one speaks of a bodhisattva, what dharma does that word bodhisattva denote?" What does that mean, a bodhisattva? This is a technical term for kind of an enlightening being, serious practitioner here. "Well," said Subhuti, "I do not, O Buddha, see that there is a dharma, bodhisattva. I also don't see any dharma called perfect wisdom." So dharma is kind of like an experience, an understanding, an experience. So I don't see anything. You said to show the bodhisattvas how to practice perfect wisdom, but where are the bodhisattvas? What is that? I don't see perfect wisdom either. "Since I neither find nor apprehend nor see a dharma bodhisattva nor a dharma perfect wisdom, what bodhisattvas should I instruct? And which perfect wisdom should I instruct them in? And yet, O Buddha, if, when this is pointed out, a bodhisattva's heart does not become cowed nor stolid, if the bodhisattva does not despair, does not despond, if she does not turn away or become dejected, this great being, who should be instructed in perfect wisdom, it is precisely that which should be recognized as the perfect wisdom of the Bodhisattva. Does that make any sense? So basically, are you so sure you are who you think you are? Are you so sure there's some teaching outside of you? If you can really let that go, maybe that's the teaching. Something like that, maybe. If the Bodhisattva is not afraid of the insubstantiality of Bodhisattvas, the insubstantiality of wisdom, then their Bodhisattva is practicing wisdom. It is precisely this that should be recognized as the perfect wisdom of that Bodhisattva, as her instruction in perfect wisdom. When she stands firm, that is her instruction and admonition. When she stands firm. Moreover, when a Bodhisattva courses in perfect wisdom and develops it, he should train himself so he does not pride himself on any thought of enlightenment, because that thought is no thought. In its essential nature, thought is transparently luminous. So here's another myth for us. And then we have a long dialogue for hundreds of pages about this, but that's the basic idea of the sutra. Let's just hear a little bit of the dialogue, because this is what happens in our heads too. Huh? So the other disciple, Shariputra, asks a question of Subhuti, who just explained all this. Shariputra says, "That thought which is no thought, is that something which is? That thought which is no thought, is that something which is?" Subhuti answers, "Does there exist, or can one apprehend in this thought of absence of thought, either a there is or a there is not? Does there exist, or can one apprehend in this state of absence of thought, a there is or a there is not?" Shariputra answers, "No, not that." Subhuti replies, "Was it then a suitable question when the Venerable Shariputra asked whether that thought which is no thought is something which is?" So now Shariputra tries another tact. "Well, when then is this state of absence of thought? What then is this state of absence of thought?" That's what we wonder, right? What is the state of absence of thought? People come to the interview room often saying, "I can't stop my thinking." Oh! So same question, right? So that's our question. What is this state of absence of thought? Subhuti, whose teaching says, "It is without modification or discrimination." It is without modification or discrimination. So that's kind of our koan for Sishin. What is this thought which is no thought? Is it something we can modify? This life, this moment. Is it something which we can manipulate or modify or discriminate, make sense of, make a new myth out of? Or is it something softer than that? Something maybe we can only have an impression of with our warm, open hand. Not something we can grab onto and grasp. And the bookmark I had in this book is the syllabus from the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines class taught by Soketsu Norman Fisher in winter of 1988. So, how about that? Things just keep coming around. A thought which is no thought. So our myth, you know, comes into fruition so quickly, doesn't it? Our myth of me, so quickly formed and reformed and formed and reformed. Yeah, we're sure it's true. We're sure that I am this kind of person. She is that kind of person. It goes this way. It doesn't go that way. And so the invitation of Sesshin this weekend is maybe not so much to change anything as to work with our attitude and our relationship to all of this. Maybe from shifting a little bit out of this position of I know how it goes to wondering how it goes. How does it go? How will it go this minute, next minute, this moment? I was talking to somebody who was experiencing a lot of pain in sitting. And we're reflecting on that powerful ability of mind to generate a vision for the future. Do you know that power of mind? These are evolutionary important things. It's good that our mind can make a guess about the future. Right? We need to have a guess of whether gathering this food or planting these seeds or entering this college is going to benefit our life. That's good. But then we internalize it, right? It becomes so strong. And so we think, this pain in my knee is going to get worse continuously for the next 72 hours. And if they don't need an ambulance by then to get me out of here, I don't know what's going to, you know. And with smaller things too, right? This habit, this personality, this confused view, it's just getting worse, right? Is that true? Is that so? And is that thought the whole experience? Is that what's really happening now? So the other invitation of Zazen of Sesshin is inviting ourselves back into the full experience of this moment. The full experience of this moment, the body, the breath, sort of sense field broader than the body and the breath. That sense of the tone of life on the edge of our perception. In the middle of that, sure, the thinking going on like the thinking does. But just like Subhuti and Shariputra were dialoguing about, is that thinking what we think it is? Is it quite so real as all that? So I really appreciate that everybody's here. It's really wonderful. Thank you, and thank you for your support of me and Red Cedar Zen and each other and our teachers, and it's such a rich web, you know. You never could have made this up on your own, you know. Who would have thought of this stuff? And you never could continue it on your own either. You need a lot of support, so every one of us, even if this is your first Zen retreat ever and you're like, what is all this stuff? Still, you're a critical part of this whole. So thank you for that. It's a courageous thing to do, because I was saying last night, it's a pretty vulnerable thing to do, to sit on your little 3-foot-wide cushion with somebody right next to you for a weekend, squeeze down the stairway and try to figure out if you're allowed to get a cup of coffee now, and all these things that we're trying to do. It's not so comfortable all the time. But luckily, we trust each other. And luckily, the ground of our practice is love. So lucky for that. Okay, well, let's just continue. There's no pithy summary or instructions, really. It's just your life. Just your life mirrored in this circumstance. So I hope you enjoy the rest of our time together. And when you really hate it, I hope you appreciate that, too. Thanks.